Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Once more to the breach, dear friends, once more. In peace, there's nothing so becomes a person as modest stillness and humility. But when the blast of adventure blows in our ears, then imitate the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood, set the teeth and stretch the nostril wide. Hold hearth the breath and bend up every spirit to your full height. For there is none of you that hath not noble luster in your eyes. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slips, straining upon the start. The game's afoot. Follow your spirit, and upon the charge cry, it is the Tom Hartman Program. My name is Jefferson Smith, and it is my last day. Thank you, and apologies to the bard. Tom will return to you on Monday. What subjects should we broach, dear friends? Last night, I was distracted. I was terrifically distracted because much of how I think a democracy needs to work is that people have to learn to agree and disagree. People have to learn to find majority and find consensus, because frankly, tyranny by 50% plus one can still be tyranny to the 49.9. We have to figure out a way to live together, to get along, to be stronger together than we are apart. That I think the essence, ultimately, of humans being able to live together is to love one another a little bit better. Not at every moment, not all the time, but a little bit better. I have to say, Tucker Carlson is straining my love. Tucker Carlson, I have to admit, dear friends, that Tucker Carlson is straining my Christian charity or my unchristian charity. But I was texting with a friend, and I realized that the ways I wanted to describe Tucker Carlson used language that I am trying to set aside from my vocabulary. And not only because it is FCC inappropriate. Today we will be dodging laser beams. Today I will be walking a tightrope. I will be dancing on the knife's edge of it not only being my last day during this grateful for me stint of sitting in for Tom Hartman during his vacation, but perhaps my last day allowed on any public airwaves, lest I fail to watch my tongue. My toxic masculinity needs a new vocabulary. I will say that the spectacle put on by Mr. Carlson to show footage to try to minimize the fact there have been 300 plus people arrested and or convicted for the events of January 6th. And that was not based on trumped up charges, pun intended. That was after deliberation, that was after application of law and facts, that was after jury deliberation, that was after a right to be defended. And Tucker Carlson, as part of the deal, I mean, like, think about this for a moment. In order for the Speaker of the House to become Speaker, he makes a deal. And he makes a deal to a propaganda machine to help them create some propaganda. And then what they do is he takes that footage, like hours and hours and hours of it, and edits it to serve his own narrative. And that narrative is to diminish that it was a big deal so that we can have somebody like that caller call and say, well, what about all the other protests? Well, you know what? The other protests did not ransack the Capitol building of the United States of America, did not put a noose on the lawn of the United States Capitol, did not break into buildings, did not push past Capitol Police. We're not ginned up saying that they needed to take back their government at the point of force. That diminishing the events of January 6th has but one purpose. And that is so that there will be a diminished clarion call to preserve democracy. We need clarion calls to preserve democracy. I recognize the Capitol building was not blown up. You showed footage of the Capitol building still standing. Yes, it is still standing. Showed footage of many people remaining outside the Capitol. Yes, many people remained outside the Capitol. I was one of the people who remained outside the Capitol. In fact, about 3,000 miles away outside of the Capitol. Footage of me would have shown me nowhere near breaking into Nancy Pelosi's office or anyone else's. But Tucker Carlson himself, I'm interested in people's thoughts. I genuinely am. Maybe I shouldn't be. I was writing texts. Here's some of the things I wrote. I'm ashamed. I will sprinkle them in. I will sprinkle them in today. But I imagine Tucker Carlson. Here's who I think he is. Now, this is to my Generation X brethren and sistren. That I imagine Tucker Carlson as a character in a John Hughes movie. But he's off screen because he was insufficiently important. He wasn't smart enough to be the Anthony Michael Hall character, and he wasn't popular enough to be the James Spader character. And that's part of his supervillain origin story. That I have this idea that he was the guy in the James Spader friend group who never made it on camera because he never got invited to anything. But he would take snapshots with James Spader so it would look like he was sort of in that friend group, like the mean kid friend group. And then James Spader, after the photo, would be taking a look at him and say, who are you? What are you doing sitting next to me? What is your name again? And even Andrew McCarthy, who was like the nice guy, wouldn't stand up for him because like Tucker had hit on his little sister. Tucker Carlson. Tucker's mom thought he was really smart and popular and told all the neighbors. Tucker's dad knew he was a little punk. He always changed the subject and got asked about him. I should have empathy for this man. Today, I do not have empathy. Let's go to your calls so I don't cut across my values further. Carmen from Colorado. Thank you, Carmen.
Oh, well, hello. It's very nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, man, I really enjoy every time that you're on, Tom. And actually, you're the one that I really wanted to talk to, because when you were on the last time, you had mentioned something. This is when they shot down the balloons.
Yep.
And the little ticky-tacks. And you kind of wanted to touch on that day, but we got on other subjects. So I'd like to go there again.
Go ahead.
Because I have an idea of what I think this possibly is. Do you remember when Trump started the Space Force?
Yes.
At the time, at the time when that happened, I thought, oh, here we go. What the heck are we doing? And I said, what are you boys up to? So, you know, Eisenhower warned us of the industrial complex.
Oh, I think I know where you're going. Keep going, Carmen.
Uh-huh. And, you know, we funnel trillions of money that has never been accounted for. The money. You know, we got to keep the oil and the, you know, the pollutants and all of the stuff. I mean, these guys just make huge amount of money. But where I'm going with the Tic Tac thing, World War II, when they had the Foo Fighters and this and that, they have been working on this. We brought German people that had been working on stuff over here that helped, you know, throw us up into outer space. And he warned, he said, the last thing that they're going to do before he died, Brahm, or I can't think of how to pronounce his name, but he warned when he was dying that the last card that they were going to pull was going to be space, for us to get in war in space.
So you think what's been going on is sort of a run-up to sort of a new frontier?
The money.
Military capability, including military spending.
Well, yes, and also with Reagan. Reagan also, in front of the UN, said the one thing that would unite us in this, and we have already, what have we done? We've already gone everywhere and practically invaded everybody. Yeah. So what's next? You know, I thought by now I was going to be living in the Jetsons. When I was a kid, you know, I saw this movie, What the World Was Going to Be Like in 1999. And it's nothing like they showed us.
No, I mean, like, Back to the Future, I was supposed to have a skateboard that could fly by now, I know. But the aliens have not yet given me that skateboard.
But I do really believe that it is possible that they want to set us up for something that may not actually be real. There's a lot of reasons why they don't want them. And most of the information the president can't even get access to. But I think Trump might have got some access. And I think that some of those classifieds, they're there.
So now we are going to break.
Time.
Thank you, Carmen. Appreciate the call. Hillary Clinton has a curiosity about UFOs, and my wife's convinced Hillary would have told us what was going on if she'd been elected president. George in Crystal Lake, Illinois.
I don't know how we have empathy for any of these people anymore when they live in an alternative reality. Maybe Gozar is the only one, you know, because, you know, I think he really is nuts. But the rest of them, it's... I don't have the brain power or the patience to be like Medin Hassan and talk to these people anymore. I can't do it.
They are straining, or they have gone past straining your empathy as well. And I understand. Here's who I think. I think Tucker Carlson paid James Spader so that Tucker Carlson could do James Spader's homework. That's what I think. I think he started trying to make friends with him. He went over to him and he said, hey, man, I'll help you with your homework. And James Spader said, who are you? And he said, no, I'll help you with your homework. You pay me $20. Does that mean I'd have to hang out with you? And then he said to James Spader, well, instead of you paying me to do your homework, what if I pay you and then I do your homework? And then James Spader said, yes, but you don't get to hang out with my friends, but you can at least interact with me when you give me the money. And I think that was part of, and then James Spader was part of when Tucker Carlson then was plotting for decades to become a supervillain. That's what I think. What do you think about my theory, sir?
I don't know.
You do not have to justify it with a response. It is not bare response. I apologize for taking your time and everybody else's time with my origin stories of Tucker Carlson. Last word for you, George.
Does anybody really believe the time when the Secret Service ushered Trump off the stage, you know, back in 2016, 2017? I'd like to know that guy. It supposedly was the only non-Trumper there, got in, and now, you know, they screamed he had a gun. And they got, you know, I think the whole thing was a plant.
Interesting. Well, it's anything goes Friday. Who knows what went that day? Thank you, George. Appreciate you listening. John from Salinas, California. This week I've been asking everybody, because it's been cold here, I've been asking everybody in California what the weather is. I imagine it's at least livable in Salinas, but how you doing, John?
I'm great. It's windy, and it was really windy last night, and then the ground is saturated, so we're waiting all the rainfall to kind of channel its way down the Salinas Valley and see if we're going to get any flooding in the next few days.
I am hopeful that with this sort of unseasonal level, or maybe just sort of rare level of rainfall, that a lot of this, I was tracking California water policy, or at least some of the developments in Los Angeles, for instance, some of the really drought-stricken population centers, and some of what they were doing for reducing water use. I hope they did some cool stuff for water capture, because they've got some, and it's a reminder that it's an intelligent place for shared and public investment. But John, that's not why you called. Go ahead.
I'm just now starting to study law at the age of 50, and I'm taking the very first class in a community college, you know, introduction to law. And I'm reading some of these cases, and I'm just really shocked. And Utah versus Strife, I think that's how you pronounce it, was one of them. It was reviewed by the Supreme Court in 2016, and basically what it was some people that lived in an apartment complex were suspicious that their neighbor was selling drugs because people were going in and out all day. And so a cop started monitoring the place. And sure enough, people were going in and out all day, but that's really all he had. But he followed one of them to a parking lot and asked to see his ID. And basically, the guy showed him his ID, he ran his name, found a warrant for traffic violations, and then searched him. Now, it's my understanding that at this point, they can only search him for things pertaining to the traffic violation and weapons. Uh-huh. But they found drugs, and basically, he got busted for the drugs. And it went to the Utah Supreme Court, and they basically said this was an illegal search to begin with. And we're tossing the evidence out, you know, on the drugs. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Roberts Court reversed that decision, saying that the warrant attenuated the illegal search. And yep. And I'm just like blown away by that. I don't know. I can't make sense of that at all.
Well, it's so what I'll say, I just tweeted out at Jefferson D. Smith a Harvard Law Review article on the that explains the case. I say the word explain, not justifies. If people want to drill deep, my kind of go-to fallback cop-out is the Oliver Wendell Holmes quote, that what a judge will do is all I mean by law. And that what has happened, the reason that the right to privacy, the right to be protected from unwarranted searches and seizures, the reason that precedent is changing is because the court has changed. Because we are no longer the Warren Court that protected civil liberties and enhanced our understanding of civil liberties, but instead is the Federalist Society organized Leonard Leo Court that is shrinking freedoms. It is shrinking or eliminating women's freedoms, and it is shrinking the very freedoms. I mean, searches and seizures are literally one of the things that were litigated and fought about in the Revolutionary War. So I appreciate you bringing it up. It's just one more example of how this court is going to be a gift that keeps on giving. And I mean gift, ironically. It is the Tom Hartman Program. Thanks for being with us. I'm Jefferson Smith, sitting in for Tom. January 6th, there was an attempted insurrection at the Capitol building in the United States. And this week, there has been an attempt by Tucker Carlson to whitewash the whole affair. With us right now is Nate Gowdy, a photojournalist who's documented the events of January 6th. The project's insurrection is a project lead with American Superhero Project. Nate, you with us?
Hey, good to be here.
Rumor on the street has it you might have even been there on the street on January 6th.
Yeah, I was running late to Trump's rally, and I was pretty sure I was the only one with the Proud Boys as they were marching toward the Capitol before other members of the press corps started joining up.
Yeah, so have you tracked at all, and you can comment on it if you choose, but I'm at least curious, have you tracked at all Tucker Carlson's treatment of this, right, the deal that was made with Kevin McCarthy to try to create, using my, I'll use my word, sort of a propaganda package around around the events of January 6th, try to diminish it and whitewash it. That's me talking, not you talking. Have you tracked any of that?
I should more, but no, I've just been reading the headlines and I'm getting the gist of it that that they're trying to frame it like it was a tourist visit and you know, nothing happened. Fake news.
You were there and you were with the Proud Boys, not as a Proud Boy, but as a journalist. Did they seem like proud tourists?
They were chanting from the Washington Monument toward the Capitol, the east front of the Capitol, chanting F-word Antifa, and they were in formation, and there were a couple hundred of them. No, they weren't happy tourists.
Maybe they were grumpy tourists. They'd had a bad breakfast. The flight had been uncomfortable, as flights sometimes are. I mean, now, heck, they're trying to consolidate JetBlue and Spirit Airlines. Who knows what airline they took? That you don't know what the bus ride might have been like, right? Maybe Antifa did something to them personally. I don't know. So did it seem to you that was there anything different about January 6th from, let's say, another tourist trip or even a protest?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was different than other times I'd photographed their Proud Boys, because usually they have a modicum of civility toward the press, at least, where they, you know, they're aware of public optics. Usually they won't put hands on photographers who are there amplifying the protests. Well, it only took them 10 minutes to try to physically assault me.
When you say try to physically assault, like, were you too much of a ninja and you dodged with the reflexes of a puma, or how did that go down?
I sure did. I'm pretty quick on my feet, and I, you know, as he lunged forward at me, I lunged backward.
Just pulled the chair on him.
And took photos, you know, as what was happening, which are all in my book. And then, you know, in the pictures, you know, I can see that, you know, I should have been pretty darn fearful, because there were others in the wings ready to join him.
Did you hear words of intent? Did you see actions that went beyond? Again, because the way that Tucker Carlson Confederates would like to frame this, oh, no, it was just a sort of typical protest. I mean, their narrative, what they'd like to say is a typical protest. They got a little atypical because, you know, there were some bad apples. But even that should be mildly justified or fully justified because of the concerns about election irregularities, right? So that's the narrative that Fox News would like to use for an attempted coup. Right. That's their narrative. My narrative would be something more like there were folks who were ginned up, some who didn't know why they were there, some of them who actively knew why they were there in the hopes of overturning an election. And Donald Trump kind of liked that idea and encouraged it a bit and didn't quite get the help that he might have wanted to get from the military, but did hold back some military to stop it. But I'm not going to put too much credence in my own narrative because I don't have all the facts. How do you see it?
It wasn't a spontaneous uprising. This was premeditated. They knew exactly what they were doing. The Proud Boys were wearing neon hats to recognize each other amidst the mob. And they coordinated. Every one of the 8 breaches of the interior of the Capitol, Proud Boys were involved in militants. And they dispersed among the mob like the fascists of the 1930s would do. You know, we've seen this before. When it all happened, was right with the leaders at the Northwest Approach, where the 5 police officers were behind the perimeter barricades, and the woman was knocked out. I had my back to the Capitol because I couldn't believe the sea of people who were, you know, it was like a high school pep rally gone terribly wrong. They were chanting 1776, fashioning themselves as freedom fighters, you know, and revolutionaries, and they were chanting, you know, fight for Trump and whose house, our house. And when I look at the footage now, at the time, I was just, you know, weirdly just excited to be there getting that part of the story. But I think I confuse excitement with fear. When I watch the footage now, God, I'm afraid. Yeah. You know, they were hopped up on not only adrenaline, but I smelled alcohol in the air. And there were, you know, and surely, you know, I can't prove it. But, you know, there must have been drugs involved. I mean, these people were on one.
As I sort of hear you tell it, that the idea was, the Proud Boys' idea was, well, yeah, there's a big protest. Not everybody's there to execute a coup, but then there are people there who can use that cover and use that crowd to create more sort of blunt force trauma to breach the Capitol, and also to create sort of a mob scene that they can do any sort of anti-patriotic mischief during.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of these people were caught up in the moment, for sure. There were 20-year-old, 30-year-old men, you know, just everyone around me was exclaiming that this was the best day of their lives. They were thrilled. And, you know, at other times, we're stuck in the mob and couldn't really navigate very well. And so people didn't know what, you know, these people who went from being protesters exercising their free speech to, you know, be an insurrectionist when they crossed a hard line, when the barricades were toppled and they walked across them,
yeah.
You know, and so these people were, you know, they're just standing there reciting the Pledge of Allegiance out of nowhere. And then they'd launch into Star Spangled Banner and then the Lord's Prayer. I mean, it was just this was not only on behalf of Trump, but on behalf of their God. And I heard conspiracy theories that, you know, I like to think I'm pretty up on what's going on. You know, I've been to 40 Trump rallies and appearances over the years, and I've been to 300 political events across the divide across 25 states. And so I'm pretty in tune with this, but I was hearing conspiracy theories that I wasn't even aware of. And, you know, at the end of the day, when the National Guards men came, they were convinced these were foreign nationals. I mean, it's just on another level.
And they were convinced by foreign nationals because they couldn't understand the vigor by which somebody would try to attack one's own capital, one's own government, one's own duly elected representatives.
They thought they were, you know, as opposed to attacking, they saw themselves as saving.
Yeah.
You know, they were doing, you know, they were saving the country, and that was the rhetoric that he'd fed them, you know. And then, you know, I was also attacked when the first perimeter barricade was breached for having professional cameras on my person. He's told them repeatedly over the years that the press are the enemy of the people.
Yeah.
You know, in attempts to just kind of discredit us.
And that's why you had to use your Puma Ninja skills.
Puma Ninja skills. And also, and just kind of, I'm a white guy. So I, you know, I'm from the Midwest, and I was able to blend in well enough despite my N95 mask othering me. You know, people forget that this was the height of the pandemic up to that point, and there was no vaccine. And so I was wearing a N95, you know, there were 4,000 reported deaths on January 6th in this country. And none of these, you know, as far as I'm concerned, these people didn't believe in it. It was just too abstract for them. And if they were wearing masks, it was to conceal their identity. And so it's just kind of it was a conflict zone, and it was a raging pandemic. I hope to never see anything like it again.
It's one of the darkest moments, one of the darkest moments in American history. And I mean, is it the dark?
Well, in modern American democracy, it's a pretty dark moment. And you know, and I like to just say, hey, you know, it's just incredible to me that these people who watch Tucker Carlson don't, you know, they don't believe their eyes, or they're willfully ignoring what's before our eyes,
yeah.
and picking and choosing.
And they can't. And the reason I'll say, and I would say two things before we go to break, and I want to say thank you, as I guess is a third thing, is first to our more sort of Trump-loving listeners, and I know there are a few of you out there, please do just imagine how you would feel if the shoe had been on the other foot. Please do imagine that. And if it hadn't been an all-white crew going in, but if it had been a multiracial crew going in, if it would have been all black crew going in, imagine how it would have looked to you and how you would have felt. First thing I want to say. And second, I want to say to all of us, the reason they can't acknowledge how bad it is because they have the veneer of patriotism. And a patriot doesn't try to take over their own government. And so they have to try to create a lie around it because they can't face the truth. Thank you so much. Appreciate it, Nate.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is by Ruth Marcus, Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. This is from the prologue. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy had a request. Would President Trump have a few minutes to speak privately? It was April 10th, 2017, a sparkling spring morning in Washington, and Kennedy was at the White House to preside over the ceremonial swearing-in of newest Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch. First time in history that a sitting justice had sworn in one of his former law clerks to join him on the bench. Just 80 days into Trump's chaotic presidency, the confirmation of Gorsuch represented a rare and welcome victory for the beleaguered new administration, reeling from court defeats of its travel ban and, despite controlling both houses of Congress, unable to repeal President Obama's signature health care law. Perhaps most important, as the prominent conservative lawyers, activists, and judges assembled in the Rose Garden that day understood, Gorsuch's addition was just one step, necessary but not sufficient, in the three-decades-long conservative bid to cement control over the high court. This effort had been as frustrating as it was lengthy. Seeming opportunities for dominance repeatedly slipped away, with Republican nominees, including Kennedy himself, turning out to be less reliably conservative than advertised. But Republicans have learned from these costly errors, assembling a farm team of potential nominees whose judicial records could be carefully scrutinized to detect any risk of ideological deviation. Gorsuch was among those who came bearing the seal of approval of the Federalist Society, the conservative legal group that had made itself the central actor in this court-shaping exercise and was playing an even more outsized role in the new administration. Trump took pains to single out one man who was not in the Rose Garden that day, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, for all he did to make this achievement possible, quoting Trump. Indeed, everyone present knew that McConnell had been the indispensable man leading to that moment. Had it not been for McConnell, President Obama would have filled the vacancy created by Justice Antonin Scalia's sudden death in February 2016, and Justice Merrick Garland would be sitting on the high court, anchoring a newly fortified liberal majority. McConnell, with his audacious announcement that the opening would not be filled, no matter that Obama had 11 months remaining in his term, had avoided that fateful outcome. His intervention meant that Gorsuch now occupied Scalia's seat, a conservative for conservative swap. The next vacancy was almost certain to be a far more critical one, shifting the court's balance instead of affirming it. On that score, all eyes were on the 80-year-old Kennedy, then serving his 30th year on the high court and, by dint of age, years of service, and political allegiance, the most likely to depart. The swing justice on an already conservative court, Kennedy was pleased about Gorsuch, but he had another former law clerk in mind as he was ushered into Trump's private dining room for an unusual session with the president and White House counsel Don McGahn. Justices are routinely invited to the White House for social events, state dinners, and holiday parties, but at least until Trump took office, such one-on-one meetings were rare in the modern era, with its finicky notions about preserving the appearance of judicial independence. Unlike the relaxed days when justices did double duty as private counselors to presidents such as Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson. In the chronically leaky Trump White House, aides took pains to keep the Trump-Kennedy meeting secret. There were no public reports about the session, and only a few senior officials ever learned what Kennedy said to Trump that day. The justice's message to the president was as consequential as it was straightforward, and it was a remarkable insertion by a sitting justice into the distinctly presidential act of judge picking. As a candidate, Trump had upended tradition by issuing a list of judges. It ultimately grew to 21, including Gorsuch, from which he pledged to pick his Supreme Court nominees. Now Kennedy had a recommendation for Trump's list. "You named one of my former clerks," Kennedy told Trump. "You should think about another one." Brett Kavanaugh. When Anthony Kennedy spoke, the Trump White House listened, with good reason. During the campaign, when Trump, against all expectations, emerged as the Republican nominee and ultimate victor over Hillary Clinton, the issue of judicial selection had been a utilitarian means to an electoral end. The socially conservative and evangelical voters Trump needed to win were deeply, understandably suspicious of the thrice-married, once-Democratic New Yorker. They were particularly dubious about how Trump would approach the critical task of shaping the federal judiciary, especially the Supreme Court. The list of high court candidates that Trump produced with the help of the Federalist Society, upending convention with typical Trumpian bravado, was explicitly aimed at calming their concerns, and it succeeded beyond the wildest expectations of its creators. On Election Day, more than a quarter of Trump voters identified the Supreme Court as the critical factor in determining their vote. White, evangelical, born-again Christians broke 81% for Trump to 16% for Hillary Clinton, meaning that Trump outperformed previous Republican nominees Mitt Romney, John McCain, and George W. Bush among such voters. In office, Trump not only keenly understood the politics of judicial selection and its importance for his reelection, he also gained a new appreciation for what the Supreme Court meant to a president's legacy. Thanks to McConnell's ruthlessness, Trump had inherited what no president had before, the gift of an existing vacancy. Supreme Ambition by Ruth Marcus.
Stan from Staten Island, your turn.
Hey, how are you tonight?
Stan, wow, Stan, were you the subject of an Eminem video? It was very famous.
Me, yeah. How did you know?
Just because. That's how I got the job as the substitute teacher. I'm just in tune, man. I'm just in tune.
I was tied to the mission.
That's fantastic.
It wasn't a real bomb.
All right. That's good. So, it's good. You don't want to use a real one, Stan. Did you want to talk about that further? Which I'm happy to do. Like anything in pop culture references.
Go ahead. I wanted to talk to this guy Tucker Carlson. You know, I read in that thing that was written by Marx that you need to belittle your enemy.
Yeah.
So that people will have no respect for them.
Yeah.
And won't trust what they say.
Yeah.
But if that guy, that moron, walking around with the helmet on,
yeah,
had access to the video of him alone being walked through the Capitol by two police, I don't think he would have had to take a plea deal for 4 years. Because he did take a plea deal only because they held 100 years over his head, and they told him, well, we're doing whatever we want, and you don't have any constitutional rights. That video should have been made open to him to show the jury, but that's not what they did. They held back any videos that didn't give the narrative that they wanted.
So you think you're sort of on the side of the people who invaded the Capitol? You think they've been sort of mistreated?
No. I'm on all of our side.
On all of our side, but you think they've been mistreated?
Don't put words in my mouth.
Forgive me, Stan.
I look at it like this. If they want to take you and put you in jail and you ask for evidence because of a thing called disclosure.
Yeah.
And those videos should have been made, those videos, all of them, all 44,000 hours, should have been made accessible so people could defend themselves.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they didn't do. But Mr. Hartman, or Mr. Principal, Vice Principal, you'd be happy living in a country that creates new laws like they did in Pennsylvania in 2020 when they changed all the voting laws. And the Pennsylvania Constitution says you can't change laws within 280 days of an election. And when Trump went to court, the liberal guy judge put in by Obama said he had no standing.
Stan, have you been tracking how much voting law change there has been in Georgia, in Michigan, in Ohio?
All right,
have you been tracking any of that stuff, man?
Yes, but was it done legally? Was it done legally with the state constitution?
Let me ask. So now I get it. Now I didn't get it now, but
don't
now
get washed. Now here you go. You're going to put words in my mouth.
Which words did I put in your mouth?
I'm the evil one too.
Which words I put in your
You're
mouth?
Going to say, with words to hear. But say now, you just said that I'm with Trump, which I'm not. I'm with every American.
No, I know that you're decrying Pennsylvania trying to make it easier for people to vote, and you and I have a disagreement on that.
You don't change the laws to make it easier for people to vote. Because if I was an African American, I don't know how I would put up with it.
This is radio, everybody. This is live, anything goes radio. Back to your calls. Justin from Lincoln, you win the most patient listener award.
Thank you so much. I enjoy the show a lot, and I'm glad that you're the substitute teacher today. The unicameral here in Lincoln, Nebraska, we don't have two houses or whatever. We don't separate, people when they do the legislative thing, you know. They're all in the same spot. They're all down at the Capitol building. They come from all the counties that come here. They're representing people, and they have these discussions in this room together. And it gets emotional. It gets crazy sometimes. It seems like a classroom. You know, you got people on the left and people on the right sitting there trying to get their bill passed, and it's crazy sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
The other day, there was a Republican who was breathing really hard into the microphone for almost 5 minutes. Didn't say much.
Yeah.
Didn't say anything at all, really. They think that some of the Democrats are playing games. I can say that one of them is not. Her name is Michaela Kavanaugh. She's doing her best.
Yeah.
And I just want to say that today, I think in the paper, one of these Republicans is talking about doing away with the unicameral. And I just thought it was kind of weird, and I don't know what it would be like without the unicameral. I guess I could look at any other state and see what it's like, but
it's slower.
I'm just kind of concerned, I guess. I just don't know. I don't think it's a good thing to get rid of the unicameral. I think that they need to be in the same room together to have these discussions, to hash it out, you know, and to solve the problems for the people. But if they're going to be in two separate rooms and not having these discussions, I can tell you, I think that the Republicans are just going to spend most of the time talking to lobbyists, and the Democrats, well, at least here in Nebraska, because we're a red state, they're just, I don't know. I guess I don't,
keep,
I don't know.
Keep us informed on it. I find the Nebraska unicameral legislature fascinating. And because we know that the bicameral, the two chamber, oh, we might unicameral, right, is a single chamber. Bicameral is two chambers. We have a House and a Senate. And people who study American history understand the reason there's a House and the Senate was because it was a compromise, right? The little states wanted equal representation. They wanted just as many senators as the big states. Montana didn't exist yet, wanted as many senators as California, also didn't exist yet. California didn't exist yet, said, that's absurd. That's absurd, Montana. We should be representing human beings, not geography. We should have a people's chamber. We should have a house. And in order to make sure they got a deal done, they said, I know, how about both? And since then, everybody's like, well, that's clearly the best way to make decisions. Clearly the best way is make sure you got to get through a house and a Senate, or a Senate and then a house and then a president. That's, of course, the way things have to happen. And Nebraska's like, well, I don't know. What about one chamber? What about one camera? And so they did it. What does it look like the future holds? Does the magic eight ball suggest that the unicameral legislature is going to be taken down, or do you think it's going to be held up?
I mean, well, the unicameral, it was, I think, 1937 is when they got it, when they started doing it here in Nebraska. Yep. And it was because a Republican, I think, went over to Australia and thought it was a good idea. Decided we should do it here. You know, I guess it got the votes. But, I mean, the Republicans are controlling things right now, so...
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it was a suggestion or if they're actually going to go through with it or what. I don't know what. I things are tough right now for Democrats here. So
I appreciate the call. I appreciate the call, Justin. And shout out to the folks in Nebraska. I know the former chair of the Democratic Party in Nebraska, and she does remarkable, marvelous work, and did marvelous work getting young people involved in politics prior to that. Jane Klebb, as I recall, is her name. And thank you so much for your call, Justin. I'm going to go
thank
to
you.
Yeah, be well. I'm going to go to Frank from Thompson Falls. Go ahead, Frank.
I'm just getting back to the Tucker Carlson thing. I think that Tucker Carlson and all the primetime entities on Fox and Rupert Murdoch should be brought up as enemies of the state, because that's what they are. It's just a right-wing propaganda arm, and they're not doing anything. They got outlawed in Australia, so why don't we outlaw them here?
Yeah, Stan hung up, and I was down to keep talking to Stan, maybe not to the benefit of myself, or hopefully it'd be some benefit to somebody else, but the purpose is, right, because it doesn't, what Tucker said doesn't change what happened, but it's giving people like Stan, right? I think it was Billy before, something to talk about. It's something to say. It's like, oh, wait, the guy with the horns might have gotten fewer years in jail had he had the video package of Tucker Carlson, or jurors all seen how Tucker Carlson saw January 6th. Had he been able to selectively edit rather than just look at sort of the most egregious particular shots, if we looked at the least egregious shots, maybe we wouldn't have gotten many years. And the question I wanted to ask Stan is, yeah, but shouldn't the guy gone to jail? Like, shouldn't you get jail time if what you do is invade the Capitol? Right? Is that illegitimate? I think they are. It's one of the most important things happening. The good news about Tucker Carlson doing it's making us talk about it again, which we should. Thank you, Frank, and I appreciate the call.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
We're reading today in the Tom Hartman Book Club from my old friend Armin Lehman's book, the late Armin Lehman. The book is titled In Hitler's Bunker, a Boy Soldier's Eyewitness Account of the Führer's Last Days. My friend Armin was the man who gave was the 16-year-old who gave the bad news to Hitler, and then he watched as Hitler walked into the room and committed suicide. It opens with an introduction from Arthur Axman, the leader of the Hitler Youth in April of 45. There's only victory or annihilation. Know no bounds in your hatred of the enemy. It is your duty to watch when others tire, to stand when others weaken. Your greatest honor is your unshakable fidelity to Adolf Hitler. It was with words such as these that the Third Reich's Hitler Youth leader, Arthur Axman, exhorted 10-year-old boys and girls being sworn into the Hitler Youth in Berlin on the eve of Adolf Hitler's last birthday. The children were being inducted into the junior echelons of the movement, the Jungvolk, the young folk, and the Jungmadel, the young maidens. I was looking on, then age 16, a member of the Hitler Youth Volkssturm, literally People's Storm. The Volkssturm was the home defense force of old men and young boys hastily assembled in the dying days of the war. Every able-bodied male between the ages of 16 and 55 was ordered to put on whatever uniform he could find, anything from postman's uniforms to firefighter's uniforms, and fight for the fatherland. The Russians called us totals because we were the result of total war. The Wehrmacht called us stew because we were a mixture of old meat and green vegetables. However, I had recently distinguished myself in battle and had even been awarded the Iron Cross Second Class. The Hitler Youth leader, Arthur Axman, at 32, was the youngest of the senior Nazis around Hitler, but his influence within Hitler's inner circle was growing daily toward the end of the war as he pledged that the Hitler Youth movement would fight to the death for the Führer and the Fatherland. In Hitler's last days, Axman was one of only a handful of Nazis, including Hitler's private secretary Martin Bormann and the cynical propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, who enjoyed the Führer's absolute trust and confidence. Axman had personally selected me to present to Hitler on the occasion of his 56th birthday at a ceremony in the Reich Chancellery in Berlin, partly because of my recent distinction in fighting the Russians, but partly, I suspect, because my role in the Hitler Youth Unit was as a courier, a melder. Hitler had won his Iron Cross as a courier in the First World War. I think that Axmann saw that as a lucky sign of some sort. At that moment, our Führer could do with every bit of luck he could get. As I watched Axmann, I did not realize it, but victory for the Allies was no longer in doubt. Germany was being overrun from every direction. City after city was being turned into ash under a ferocious Allied bombing campaign, unprecedented in its intensity. I, along with several hundred other teenage soldiers of the Hitler Youth Volkssturm, was among the last who would serve Hitler's regime in Berlin, in the much-vaulted citadel of the Führer's last redoubt in the dying days of the war. I didn't know it at the time, but I would soon be serving as a courier in his bunker beneath the Chancellery. It was an experience that would bring me into contact with some of the most notorious Nazis of the time, as well as some of the most decent soldiers and civilians struggling to cope with the death wish Hitler had imposed upon all Germans. Facing total defeat, the Führer was now willing to sacrifice everything and everybody, including even the youngest and most innocent of German lives. It wasn't just males, either. The Bund Deutscher Mädel, the German Girls Legion, or BDM, was the female section of the Hitler Youth. They, too, sacrificed their lives for the Führer. I did not realize at the time that Germany faced total defeat. I still believed in the myth of our, quote, miracle weapons that was widely circulated before the end of the war. I had no comprehension of the sheer evil that was at the heart of the Nazi regime. Yet I was prepared to lay down my life for Hitler in defense of the fatherland and the noble ideals of the National Socialist movement. I was elated at the prospect of greeting Hitler the following morning on his 56th and last birthday. To comprehend why anybody can have been so thoroughly taken in by such a deception, one must understand a little about my background. I was 4 years old when Adolf Hitler became Reich Chancellor of a coalition cabinet in Germany. It was 30 January 1933. Later, that historic date became known as Die Machtergreifung, the seizure of might. Absolute power, as Hitler has taught us, often brings about primal chaos. But in Hitler's case, it went beyond that. His absolute control over the minds of countless individuals created a living hell that destroyed the lives of millions of people in a human catastrophe too enormous to comprehend. It wasn't like that in the beginning. It all started with promises of a better life. My grandfather, for example, an old guard Nazi party member and an early follower of Hitler, was convinced that a fast economic recovery would come about because of Hitler. It did. He was also sure that Germany would be avenged for the Treaty of Versailles. It was. My father believed in Hitler as well. He not only became a member of the National Socialist Workers' Party, as thousands did, and joined the SS, he also turned into a fanatical disciple of what he looked upon as the new order needed to restore Germany to the glory it deserved. My father was an authoritarian, so perhaps it's understandable that he admired the new regime. But my mother was as loving and caring a soul as you could possibly imagine, and she too admired Adolf Hitler. She too thought Adolf Hitler had been anointed by God to lead Germany to its historic destiny as the greatest nation on earth. Most Germans did. It may come as a shock or a mild surprise, but women were among Hitler's most ardent followers in Hitler's bunker.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Let's go to Tom from Philadelphia. How you doing, Tom?
I just had a brief comment about the Kevin McCarthy handing over the video to Tucker Carlson business.
Yep.
I wish I would hear somebody, one of our politicians, stand up and say, oh, these people kind of tiptoe around the word fascist. That is straight out of the fascist handbook, cooperation between government, corrupt government officials, yep, and big business. It's just hits you in the face.
No,
I don't know why we don't hear that more often. And isn't Tucker aiding and giving comfort to the enemy of the, yes, United States?
Yes.
Somebody who, I just don't understand how it doesn't make a bigger, isn't an even bigger issue.
Yeah, and I, when Donald Trump was elected, the thing I asked was, imagine it were 1932, and we lived in Germany, what do we wish we would have done? That it's, and I think there's a few challenges here. One is because there's so many wonderful things we have to atone for, to be sure, but also so many wonderful things about this country. And the good news about January 6th is the government still stands, and Joe Biden remained president, and the election And we did have, if not the fully peaceful, it's still ultimately a peaceful transition of power. That is all to be, we should all be thankful for that. I don't think we have the vocabulary, the shared understanding of the threats. I'm not going so far as we take it for granted, but I think on the margins we kind of do. I think there's so many people, particularly the wealthy and comfortable, who do value democracy and realize the value that democracy has had even to their wealth and comfort, that are like, well, is it really that serious? And it's hard. And if you cry wolf all the time, right, eventually people don't hear it. But having state media, having a 30% plus block of people, that's all it took for Hitler to get elected. And I know, how long does it take before Hitler gets cited? I understand. But a powerfully organized, militarized, with communications technology minority can take over a technologically advanced country. Like, that has happened before. And it really is scary. And I don't like admitting how scary it is, because I like going about my day. I like petting my dog. He's been here every day. He just sits here politely. I haven't brought him up because in case he barked, I wanted to blame it on somebody else's dog. But I want to be able to just walk my dog and have a nice time. And I don't think we have the rhetorical architecture prepared to deal with what we're dealing with now. We certainly don't have the communications apparatuses, right? Like, that's one of the reasons I value this show so much. But there's never been a threat like Fox News. There's been a threat like Donald Trump. That hasn't happened in the country yet, and we got to figure out how to deal with it. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I would love there to be the kind of media outreach on the left that Fox gives the right. Yeah. Instead, we've got a guy who is third in line to be president of the United States, who is openly, unapologetically handing a huge propaganda tool to help cement the big lie about the election.
Yeah.
And I run around like Chicken Little all the time saying the sky is falling, to the point where even my friends and family, I start to open up and I say, Tom, okay, that's enough, because it seems to me like the bad guys are making a huge amount of progress.
For sure.
Years ago, to have somebody like Marjorie Taylor Greene in Congress, even when she was, I would say, well, I haven't gotten bad enough that she'll be allowed to stick around. That just can't be.
Yeah, or put on a national security committee.
And being speaker, which she may as well, she's just basically a Russian agent, as far as I'm concerned, and among other things.
Yeah, well, no,
I just think more people don't see it.
I appreciate it, and I think it is, I mean, if you use the second coming type on the head of the newspaper every day, people don't see the second coming type as important anymore, and it's a challenge. And I don't want to criticize NPR, because I so value them, and I think public media is so very important, but we lack the collective tone of voice. Right? I think that the liberal politeness. And I don't mean political persuasion. I mean by liberal merely. I mean the tradition of politeness. I mean liberal meaning much of what happened after World War II, which includes very much a more right-wing economic perspective. That the word liberal, to be clear. But I remember when during the Muslim ban, I was listening to NPR, and NPR was using the same tone of voice, and as they're trained to do. Say, well, the president has banned people from Muslim countries from entering the United States. And I remember the children from South America and Mexico being put into cages. I'm like, at some point, we have to have another tone of voice. At some point, there has to be, when George Will says, oh, there's already liberal media, it's NPR. It's like, listen, public media, public television, deeply important. We have to have pro-democracy, purpose-driven media, including public media. I wish it could double and triple its public funding. And at the same time, we need more outlets that allow for a different tone of voice, because at some point, what if people are just straight up put in work camps? And we have the same tone of voice. Oh, well, thousands of people were rounded up, put in work camps today. Some people think it's a bad thing. Others think it's justified, because those people are, I don't know, the wrong sort of people. That we don't have all of the tools to deal with the rising threat. Leonard Leo just got $1.6 billion, Right? This is the guy who architected the Federalist Society takeover of the Supreme Court and eviscerated women's right to choose. That's not just, that didn't happen because we elected one president. That didn't happen because of a change of mind of or a different reading of precedent by some Supreme Court justice. That happened because of an onward, beat by beat, drumbeat by drumbeat, step by step, brick by brick, dollar by dollar, media propaganda piece by media propaganda piece, voter suppression by voter suppression, pride swallowing siege to overtake the federal judiciary. And then as his reward, he got $1.6 billion, the biggest gift that anyone has ever given or received in the history of world politics. And the purpose, and shout out to ProPublica, the purpose is to create the Federalist Society of everything, of media, of finance, of technology, of entertainment, of education, to create the Federalist Society of everything. That Leonard Leo's argument, his case that he made to Barside, it's S-E-I-D, I think it's Barside, that's the industrialist who just turned 90 and said, well, why don't I give you $1.6 billion? Why don't I make you the, Clarence Thomas called Leonard Leo the third most powerful person in the world. And I said, why don't I add to that power by giving you over $1 billion to spend? And Leonard Leo's case was, look what we did with the Federalist Society. We can do the Federalist Society of everything. And they build something called the Teneo Network. And what's the Teneo Network? Well, you haven't heard about it that much yet because they're not always supposed to talk about it. Again, thank you to ProPublica. But it includes Josh Hawley, and it includes sort of the next generation of right-wing strategists to create the Federalist Society of everything. This is something that is worth more than my voice. This is something that is worth, I don't know, something approaching the Second Coming type. This is worth asking more friends to join this community that y'all have built over the years, and why I appreciate you so much.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.